Hi, I'm Dr. Gay Carlson, president of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, with another of my screenside chats for our ACAP members. For those of you who haven't been here before, screenside chats are meant to share timely clinical practice and other information from experts on key topics, mostly focused on the COVID-19 pandemic, but not completely. I'm hoping that they'll be informative, comfortable, and fill a niche not otherwise addressed by materials otherwise available. They harken back to President Roosevelt's fireside chats in World War II and the Great Depression. Today we have a special chats in recognition of the fact that our fellows are graduating, going on to the next part of their lives. And I thought what would be fun would be to have one of those fellows interview me, turn the tables of this interview. So let me introduce Dr. Amanda Downey, who's the Johnny Showalter MD resident member to ACAP's council. She's currently the co-chair of the Committee on Medical Students and Residents. She's soon to be graduating from the triple board program at Pittsburgh at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and will be joining the faculty at the University of California in San Francisco. She'll be the associate medical director of the Eating Disorders Program, and she will be traveling there with her fiance and a Great Pyrenees, which I looked up online because I'm not a dog expert, and they are big dogs, but they are really cute. Anyway, she will be traveling out there with her fiance to start her new life. So Amanda, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thanks so much, Dr. Carlson. So I have the pleasure of introducing you all to Dr. Gay Carlson, who, as you know, is the president of ACAP until October 2021. Before that, she was on council, and before that, the program chair for 4 years. Her presidential initiative is emotion dysregulation in children, coming together to treat the sickest kids. She's also a busy professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the Renaissance School of Medicine at Stony Brook, formerly Stony Brook University School of Medicine, where she founded and directed the division until 2013. She is still married to her medical school cadaver partner, Dr. Harold Carlson, and they have 2 sons, one of whom is a nursing supervisor and the other a TV reporter. Dr. Carlson, so excited to be with you today. So I want to explain a little bit about what we did to make this happen. First, we polled graduating fellows from all over the country to really hear what was on your minds. We wanted to know what questions you had, what comments you had for Dr. Carlson, and we got a sample from all over, got some great questions. Secondly, we actually reached out to training directors across the country to compile a list of graduating fellow names, and you'll see those names scrolling on the side of your screen during this chat. This was our way of just recognizing the accomplishments of graduating fellows all over the country, and also knowing that, right, our graduations are going to look a little bit different this year, so we wanted to do something special in acknowledgement of that. So Dr. Carlson, you have so much experience and wisdom, and we got such great questions from all over the country. I figure let's just dive right in.
Dive away.
So, you know, there was a lot of interest from fellows about what the beginning of your career looked like. What made you successful? How did you get your start? And so folks really wanted to know, what was really like the toughest lesson you learned as an early career psychiatrist?
I gave that question some thought. Amanda gave me a hint as to which question she was going to ask me, so I wouldn't sit here and go, humma, humma, humma. And so I thought about that, and I was going to give you some great, profound, thoughtful piece of advice. But you know what I really didn't know how to do when I finished my training is I didn't know how to negotiate. I did not know how to look out for myself in terms of getting a job. And it was a tough lesson because for my first job after, well, I finished UCLA and I stayed on the faculty for 8 years. And then my next job, I just figured they gave me the salary they gave me and I didn't give it another thought. And I found out I should have negotiated. And that was something that I think may not be as much of a problem now. There are more women in medicine. There's more women in child psychiatry. I think we take care of each other better. We look out for those kinds of things. But that was a lesson that I learned through experience, and it was a valuable one.
I think that's a great thought. And we probably don't talk about it enough in training, how to negotiate. But I heard a few things. Certainly, there are more resources now. And reaching out to mentors is probably a good way to learn a negotiating skill.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. And I think money is something that we're embarrassed to talk about. I don't know. It's like, gee, I shouldn't bother my professors who want to know from me how to use this medication, how to do that therapy or what diagnosis to make. I can't ask them, what do I do to go in and get a job? Don't make that mistake. People will be more than happy to, I think, share their experiences with you. I know I would be.
And I think in my experience, mentors are willing to role play with you, negotiating scenarios. And so asking for that might be a fruitful experience.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, whether this is right or wrong, I think there is still this tension that young physicians feel who balancing families and young children and going into new academic or professional careers. Do you have advice for the new early career psychiatrist who's struggling to balance all of those things?
I guess two things. First of all, it's tough. It really is tough. We put off having kids until I was done with my fellowship. We didn't have a support system where we were. We didn't have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so we couldn't raise kids the way I wanted to raise them. So you have to have reasonable expectations of yourself. My husband is also a professional. And we had to do a give and take in terms of how we managed our careers, how we managed where we were, how we managed the kids. And speaking of negotiating, it wasn't the negotiation, well, this is my turn. No, it's my turn. It wasn't that kind of a negotiation. But you're sort of thinking about how you manage those things. It's not easy. The other thing that I was thinking about was a woman who was kind of a mentor to me. You know, one of the things that we're missing in this COVID business is casual conversations with each other, right? So we're having a formal conversation. We can't chit-chat in the hallways or the way we do. Well, one of the chit-chats I had was a woman, her name was Irene Goldenberg. She was a psychologist at UCLA. And we used to talk about things. She was older than I was, of course. And I looked up to her and she said, Jay, one of the things, if you're going to be a professional woman, you have to learn is one action always should accomplish at least two other things. And this is a direct quote. So when I answer the door, I have a dust rag in my hand and I dust the furniture on the way to opening the door. Now, that was metaphorically speaking. I can't imagine Irene with a dust rag in her hand. But the point of it was that you need to be efficient about what it is you do. And multitasking is something you need to be able to learn. And I think if you can organize yourself and use your time wisely, you can accomplish quite a bit.
So you feel like it's doable, even though, right, the landscape has changed so much since you were an early career psychiatrist.
You know, that's a fair observation, Amanda. I don't know that I would be able to do now what I did in my first job. My first job was running an inpatient unit at UCLA. And I remember, well, when I had my first son, I worked half time because that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to be home with my son. For my second son, I had things a little bit better organized. And but I could leave the job. I could leave the job at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I remember when people would say, oh, do you have a minute? Yeah, walk me to the car. And people learned they better finish their whatever they wanted to know because I got in the car and left. I don't know if I could do that now. You admit kids at all hours. The demands are different. So I don't know that I could do quite the same thing, and I'm humble about it. But I think the same observation is true. You really need to be thoughtful about how you're expending your time. And if you can get one gesture to serve two purposes, so much the better.
Yeah, I love that. And being thoughtful maybe in advance about how you're setting boundaries for yourself.
Setting boundaries, setting limits, And the expectations are also setting limits on yourself, realizing that people who don't have families, don't have kids, are having it further in their career than you are. It may be that you get to the finish line at the same point and you do it somewhat differently. My college roommate who got a PhD in psychology didn't do that until after her kids were older. But by the time we got to about 40 or 45, we were kind of in a similar place. We had just, we just organized it differently.
Right. Oh, I love that. Dr. Carlson, we're entering this new season with, I think, tons of new challenges for the field and rapid changes in response to the coronavirus pandemic. Is there a real trap that you feel like new graduates should look out for as we're entering the workforce in this kind of strange time?
I don't know that there's a particular, unprecedented is the word on everybody's lips. This is unprecedented. Yeah. So I don't have any precedented advice. I think one of the things that I have found a trap for trainees is they don't ask for help. I don't know whether it's not a matter of you don't have time, whether you're afraid, whether you're embarrassed, whether you don't know you need help. But asking for help is really important. Nobody expects you to know everything when you finish your training program. You just put your toe in the water at that point. We've hopefully given you enough training so that you know where the water is and you know where your foot is and you can put your foot in the water. But it's by no means everything that you have to know. You really, please admit when you don't know something. Saying to a patient, I can't answer that question. I can find out. I don't know whether I don't know it or nobody knows it or there's not an answer to it. I'll see if I can find out and get back to you. And, if your professor or somebody asks you a question you don't have an answer to, don't BS them. Say, I don't know. Help me think about it or tell me where to look or give me a reference. But ask.
I love that. I think there's been a lot of recent talk about this phenomenon of imposter syndrome, right? And so recognizing that we should feel confident, we've had good training, we've dedicated our life to this, and also we need to stay humble and ask. And we have great mentors in the field who are willing to serve in that role for us. I love that advice. So staying humble, asking for help when you need it.
Yeah. I think one of the things that you learn is that development is something that continues. It isn't development like the difference between a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. I think the difference between a first-year fellow and somebody who's been out for 5 years and somebody that's been out for 15 years, there's a developmental progression that goes on. Mm-hmm. I think of myself as a young faculty person, and as you know, I've been in academia my whole life, but I think of some of the things that I said and I did and I assumed, and I go, it's embarrassing. On the other hand, I was young and stupid. And so I hope that the people who were with me at that time cut me a little slack and gave me some forgiveness. I know that it's helped me try to be the same way with younger people that I think have a lot to learn and say, some of this I can help them with and some of this, it's like your teenage kids, they've got to learn it for themselves. So I don't think that's a COVID-19 issue. I think that's a developmental thing.
Yeah. And I think, for us to hear from mentors that you have made mistakes, you have asked for forgiveness, folks have helped you along the way, I think that's comforting for us launching into this new world and knowing that we're going to make mistakes and that's okay.
And I think, as you get into your, when you get older and you're at the peak of your career. I remember when I first got to Stony Brook and I started the division, and there really weren't very many people there. And one of the first people I hired who's still there, Dr. Judy Kroll, has been our training director for many years. And I remember she was a junior faculty person, and she came into my office and she asked me some question. I can't even remember what the question was. But anyway, she asked me a question that I didn't have an answer to. And I remember desperately looking around like, who can I call? Because I was used to being at large centers where, you know, there was somebody I could call. And there was nobody. And I thought, oh my God, it's me. The one that has to answer that question. But there's always the phone. There's always email. There's always a way to get help. So, you know, I don't think that that changes at any age.
Yes. Oh, I love that. Dr. Carlson, we got a lot of questions from graduating fellows about obviously how rapidly things are changing in response to COVID-19. And I know the Academy has addressed a lot of things related to that. But I'm curious to hear from you. What changes do you envision or hope for in the field really following this crisis, be it from an advocacy standpoint, regulations being lifted? What do you see as kind of the immediate future of the field?
Well, the good news and the bad news, and I don't think these are innovative thoughts. I think everybody has been impressed with two things. First of all, how well telepsychiatry has worked. And I call it cheap man's telepsychiatry. Cheap man's telepsychiatry being sort of what we're doing here with a Zoom call and, you know, getting our patients online and talking with them. And there are... So the good news is that's working surprisingly well. The bad news is that there are some things you can't do with telepsychiatry. And I think it's incumbent on us to reorganize and come up with ways of saying, okay, these are the ones we can do and these are the ones that we can't do. So that's a whole new learning paradigm. I know for me, who's done structured mental statuses for most of my life, I can't do the same thing now. I have to come up with a whole bunch of new norms. But I think it's been an interesting and positive experience having that. I think getting rid of some of the stupid rules that we've had that have saddled our progress, we don't miss. One of my colleagues was talking about in the telepsychiatry business how many emergency room visits he saved by being able to call somebody back and talk down a situation. And he was pleasantly surprised how well that worked. Well, that's a no duh. Why haven't we been doing that? Well, we haven't been doing that because we don't get paid for it.
Okay? Yeah.
So, you know, the question about what kind of progress we can make if we didn't have some of the barriers that we've got, I think we could make a whole lot of progress in terms of providing better health care and taking our scarce resources and using them better. So those are on the positive side. Mm-hmm. On the negative side, and I don't think that this has a I don't know that I can say that this has anything to do with COVID-19, but it's certainly the way I've seen things. I'm going to get on my soapbox for a minute here. We are destroying training, okay? We are destroying training. The amount of time junior faculty and senior faculty have to spend generating RVUs is not helping progress. The kind of supervision that we can give our trainees. And you've only experienced what you've experienced, and I don't know what you have at Pitt. I know what I see traveling, and I know what I experience in my own site. We don't spend nearly the amount of time with our trainees that I got when I was a fellow, and that I gave up until about 5 years ago.
Wow.
Okay. We are in danger of not just being a freeze that freezes the oranges on the orange tree. We're going to kill the trees, because if we don't train you right, then you're not going to train the next generation right. And in, you know, basically one generation, we will have, and this isn't just true for child psychiatry, by the way, I think this is true for all of clinical medicine. we won't be able to have the expertise that we need when we need it. And yes, we need people that see somebody every 15 minutes and that can be efficient. We also need somebody who's able to think through a problem and are the experts that we go to when we have a really tough question. And if we're not raising those people, then we're not going to have them when we need it. So I hope we don't find ourselves in 5 to 10 years where we have found ourselves with this pandemic, which is basically with our pants down, because we were expedient about being cost effective and squeezing every ounce of productivity out of somebody and not realizing, you know, we've got to put some emphasis here on training and what we want to see generated in future years. So that's my concern message.
Now, as we enter the workforce, are there points of advocacy or things that we can do to protect that training space and time?
You know, I don't know. I think probably the piece that COVID is going to make even worse is hospitals are in even bigger troubles than they were before. I mean, the amount of money that I'm sure our hospitals have lost in taking care of really sick people, and I don't know where the money's coming from now. You know, I'm humble enough to know that I don't think people have come up with some of these productivity things just because they want to destroy training. All right. I'm not that stupid.
Yeah.
I think that some of the productivity demands are because people want better salaries. Mm-hmm. When I was a junior faculty person, I had a working husband. And, you know, between the two of us, we made a living wage. But, you know, if I'd been in private practice, I could have earned a whole lot more.
Yeah.
So if you're going to recruit me into academic medicine now, maybe I want a good salary. Well, the salary isn't going to come from the sky. The salary isn't going to come from the dean. The salary isn't going to come from the chairman. The salary's got to come from someplace. And so we sort of come back down to appropriate reimbursement. We come back down to appropriate expectations. We come down to having something worth buying. It's a complicated issue. It doesn't lend itself to a simple solution. I'm just here to say you need to be mindful of the future and the fact that training isn't something that you can, that's not a can you can kick down the road, because there won't be anybody there to do it when you kick the can down the road, just like there weren't any respirators when we needed them, and then we had to scramble and, you know, never did get an adequate supply of them. So I just want people to be mindful of that now. And I'm sorry to come back to the same hobby horse, but I really feel strongly about that one.
No, I think, and especially in light of the workforce shortage, right? I think the next generation has to be mindful of those things and care deeply about training to preserve its importance. So thank you for that. Dr. Carlson, I know we can't do this, but if we could send you back in time and tell yourself something, your younger self, or give yourself advice as you were graduating fellowship, what advice would you give to yourself?
Well, first of all, I have to say that that concept of talking to your younger self, my friend Harold Koplowitz has a whole series that he does in Mental Health Month, the month of May that just passed, where he has all sorts of celebrities in trying to destigmatize psychopathology, psychiatric disorders. He's got this talking to your younger self, and it's kind of fun to watch the celebrities talking to their younger self. So it's not a concept that's totally foreign to me. If I were to talk to my younger self, I would give myself the pep talk, or I would come up with some wisdom. Like, there's a wonderful graduation speech that was called, it's called Wear Sunscreen. I don't know if you've heard of it. People might want to look it up afterwards. A columnist named Mary Shimich from the Chicago Tribune came up with this graduation speech in 1997. It starts out with wear sunscreen. There's all sorts of evidence as to the effectiveness of sunscreen. Wear sunscreen. And then she goes on talking about words of wisdom. And she ends up with, trust me on this, wear sunscreen. So I love that talk. I've adapted that to 2020, and I'm going to say, wash your hands, okay, for 20 seconds. The masks, you know, I can't say take to your grave, wear masks, or God help us, I hope I don't say take to our grave, stay 6 feet apart.
Please.
But washing your hands is something, and it's probably a good thing to do for the rest of your life. So let me start out with a wash your hands.
Oh.
I have a sign in my office. It says, in God we trust, everyone else shows us data.
Mm.
I was given that actually when I finished my training at NIMH. And it's something that I've stood by. I think that there's lots of opinions out there, but where possible, I would like to have evidence to back up what I'm hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Make compromises. You're going to have to make compromises in your life and be prepared to make compromise.
Mm-hmm.
Don't compromise your integrity.
Mm.
The point at which, somebody is asking you to do something that's wrong, don't do it. That sounds maybe a little sanctimonious. Mm-hmm. But that's one corner I don't think you should cut. If you decide to have a life partner, find someone who'll be the wind beneath your wings, and you can be the wind beneath that other person's wings. You were sort of asking me before about having a family. As I said, I think there's a give and take there. Careers are definitely more complicated with a partner and with children, and you need to know that going into it. It's mm-hmm. certainly got its pleasures and it's got its pains. Mm-hmm. And as Thumper's mother said, I think you have to take the leaves as well as the flowers. And so, you know, be prepared for that. Similar to choosing your partner wisely, choose your boss wisely. If you have a choice, choose your boss wisely. You need to find somebody that understands the value of a good colleague.
Mm-hmm.
You want to have somebody who's mature enough to look on you as a mentee, as somebody who they will help up the ladder and not stomp on your hand as you're trying to climb up. Somebody who, the way a parent takes pride in the accomplishment of their children, looks at the accomplishment of their junior colleagues as something that they can take pride in and not consider it a threat.
Mm.
When you give a professional talk, pretend you're talking to your mother or your father. I don't mean to have a bias there. My dad was a PhD in psychology, so he had some idea of what I did for a living. My mom was a nurse, so she understood medicine, but she never really did understand child psychiatry. And she sure as shooting didn't understand academic medicine. And so when I give a talk, I try to pretend I'm explaining it to her, which means that I can use down-to-earth language, mm-hmm. and I can give it in a way that a smart lay person can understand. We're in a collaborative profession. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the fun parts about child and adolescent psychiatry. When I first started out, I was going to be an internist. You're looking at a real fossil here. I was the only woman house staff where I did my internship, which was a Jewish hospital in St. Louis. And I never really thought about that. I'm getting sort of an aside here, but I never really thought about it. I went back and was looking at some old photographs. There's a huge photograph of, I don't know, 50 or 60 house staff. I was the only woman there. And I got to be friends with the nurses because they were other women.
Yes.
And they were really valuable colleagues that I had never appreciated as a medical student.
Yes.
And I really learned how valuable the collaboration was and how important a good nurse was.
Yes.
Sometimes they covered your you-know-what for you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that was sort of a piece of education that I don't know that I was getting at the time.
Right.
But subsequently, when I went to NIMH to do basically a research fellowship, mm-hmm. I got to, you know, I liked the nurses. I sort of already knew what their value was. I got to understand what a social worker was. We had a wonderful social worker on the affective disorders unit where I was. I mean, she was smart as a whip and a better clinician than most of the doctors that were there.
Wow.
So I understood the value of her, because before that, to me, a social worker was somebody that got you into a nursing home.
Right.
And so getting into child psychiatry was fun, because not only did you have the nurses and the social workers, mm-hmm. you had psychologists, you had speech pathologists, you had occupational therapists, you had recreational therapists. It was a whole orchestra of people
yes.
that you could recruit to help you with this child and family. I love that part of our job. I love the collaboration part of it. And so I really think that that's something that we need to embrace, and we need to know how to work with each other to get the best out of each other to advance child development and child mental health. We're doctors, we should know treatments. We should probably, I mean, it would be great if we knew how to do everything. I don't think it's possible to know how to do everything, but we need to know when it's being done well. So, full disclosure, I don't know how to do DBT, but I know what goes into DBT.
Yes.
The same thing about collaborative problem solving. I don't know how to do it, but I know what goes into it. And so when somebody comes along and they say, oh, well, they've had DBT or CBT or some other TTT, and I say, well, tell me what you did with a therapist. And I don't hear things like homework assignments or, you know, groups. Or
right.
I know that they're not getting what they're supposed mm-hmm. to be getting.
Right.
So you need to know what quality is so that you can redirect the person. Or when they say, well, it hasn't worked, it's kind of like having somebody come to you and say the best dose of methylphenidate that you ever had was 5 milligrams and it didn't work. You have to be able to say, well, there's more to it than just 5 milligrams.
Yes.
So I think we need to be aware of treatment being done competently. I think one of the things that I've liked most about child psychiatry is the kids. I didn't start out going into child psychiatry. I started out because I didn't understand when an adult patient of mine was crabbing about her 12-year-old, I couldn't tell from what she said whether she was the problem or the kid was the problem. And I know she told me she'd had stomach pain or a headache or something. I could have asked questions to make a distinction between whether she had an anxiety problem or whether she needed to see an internist. I couldn't do that with her kid. So I wanted to go into child psychiatry to learn something more about kids. And of course, I was interested in manic depressive illness, and I wanted to know why this familial disorder didn't occur in kids. And so I wanted to learn more about child development. So I got into child psychiatry. And lo and behold, not only did I like the collaborative parts of it, I love the kids. You know, they are a trip, even when they've got the worst problem in the world. I can remember one of the kids that was in a residential program that I was doing some work with. And he had a big mouth on him, and he didn't mind swearing, and he didn't care who he swore at. And I remember walking through campus with a TV reporter or a newspaper reporter, and the kid passed me, and he flipped me the middle finger, and he said, sit on it and spin. Well, I have a graphic memory, and I cracked up.
Oh my God.
I mean, I couldn't help myself. I just laughed.
Oh.
And he laughed, and he said, have a nice day, Dr. Carlson. And the reporter was so amazed
oh.
that that laughter diffused this kid's, you know, clearly flipping you the finger isn't the nicest thing to do. And it's clearly embarrassing when you're with a stranger.
Yes.
But I mean, just that just was funny to me. And I have found that humor has been a really helpful thing. But kids know it when they like, when you like them. And so I think that you should enjoy the child in you. And I think you should enjoy the kids you see. And so I guess maybe that's my final word of wisdom.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I think I need to rewatch so I can take some notes.
Well, I think that's probably enough. I've enjoyed being interviewed. I think the questions that you've asked have been really great. I expect that you will continue to have a wonderful career. I've really enjoyed the trainees that I have worked with over the years, and I wish all of you who I have not had the privilege of knowing, as well as those who I have had the privilege of knowing, a really good life. Thank you very much for being with us at another Screenside Chats. This is Dr. Gay Carlson with Dr. Amanda Downey. Have a nice day. I have one final piece of advice. For those of you who haven't done so, join ACAP. It's a great professional home. It's good for colleagues, for professional growth, for CME and MOC. And one final word, wash your hands. This is Gay Carlson for Screenside Chats. Thank you for your attention.